Welcome to episode 34 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. I'm joined today by Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and Justice Department and now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. Mark Fry, the former chief of staff for the Office of Policy Development at the Department of Homeland Security and now a senior director in Steptoe's D.C. office. Our guest commentator is Dr. Phyllis Schneck, the Deputy Undersecretary for Cybersecurity for the National Protection and Programs Directorate, or NPPD, at the Department of Homeland Security. She is the chief cybersecurity official for DHS and supports its mission of strengthening the security and resilience of the nation's critical infrastructure. And I'm Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where I supervise criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and now do criminal and civil litigation in the D.C. office at Steptoe. Let's get started. Michael, do you want to take us through this week in NSA?
Well, first I want to congratulate you on being promoted to the anchor seat. I think Stuart had a nice run, but we're ready for the Weinstein era now.
I think it'll be short-lived.
Well, the, speaking of short-lived, I think there's not a lot to report about the NSA this week, but there was a series of interesting stories about a case in which Yahoo tried to challenge the PRISM program before the FISA court. That's the program that is targeted at non-U.S. persons outside the U.S. And their communications. And what's interesting about it is that it can pick up communications with people in the U.S. as long as they're not the targets, and the surveillance does not need to be predicated on individual orders for each suspect, but there's this broad programmatic approval from the FISA court. So Yahoo challenged the first, or perhaps it's the second iteration of that program that was done under the Protect America Act before the program became permanent. And what's interesting is the documents from that case were unsealed last week by the FISA Court of Review, and it turns out that the U.S. government threatened Yahoo with fines of up to $250,000 a day if it failed to comply once the FISA Court ordered it to. Really, this is just the reason this is such big news is because Yahoo's trying to make it big news because communications companies are bending over backwards, understandably, to show how ardently they fight for their users' privacy, because there's been so much criticism of them, particularly after the Snowden leaks. So Yahoo, you know, wants to show that it was fighting tooth and nail to protect its users' privacy against what they said was just overweening government surveillance efforts.
Also this week, Cisco got a big victory in California in a lawsuit under the Alien Tort Statute related to its work in China. What can you tell us about that, Michael?
Yeah, this is, I think, a really important case. You know, there have been suits by political dissidents, people who were tortured in other countries, and they brought suit oftentimes against American technology companies in particular, saying that they aided and abetted the torture of these of the plaintiffs or their disappearance for a time, things like that, by providing technology to the foreign government. Usually it ends up being some sort of communications technology or surveillance technology. In this case, was just like that, what I just described. And so the allegations were that Cisco helped China set up this surveillance system that would allow it to identify, monitor, track, and locate members of the religious group Falun Gong, the religious movement. And the judge dismissed the case, finding that the Alien Tort Statute was not available because there was insufficient allegations that the matter touched and concerned the United States. The Supreme Court ruled fairly recently in the Kiobel case that you can't bring an Alien Tort Statute claim if something significant didn't happen in the United States. Here the plaintiffs tried to meet that standard by saying, look, you got an American company that designed the surveillance system in the United States. It knew that China was going to use this technology for repressive purposes. It had discussions with the Chinese about this. It had internal discussions about the risk that its technology would be used in a bad way by China. But Judge Kuh said that's not enough. There have to be allegations that the company actually directed, planned, or committed the human rights abuses itself from the United States. To me, that's at the very least a strict or narrow interpretation of the Kiobel standards, and in fact, I think it elevates the standard beyond where the Supreme Court put it, and it will make it very difficult for anybody to sue United States companies for involvement in foreign repression of dissidents. She also said that aiding and abetting claim didn't lie because there was no evidence that Cisco intended for its product to be used in repression. And she also dismissed a Torture Victims Protection Act claim on the ground that statute does not provide for aiding and abetting liability. That's an issue that has split the courts. And so she sided with the courts that have rejected that sort of a claim. So I think we'll continue to see these sorts of suits, but there has been a trend towards dismissing them by and large. So I think unless this is reversed by the Ninth Circuit, it just will continue to make these cases more difficult to bring.
So even though Stuart isn't here this week, we're obligated to give an update on his favorite topic, which is the right to be forgotten. Google is in the process of holding public meetings in 7 European cities to debate the implications of the right to be forgotten. Google said publicly that they've received over 100,000 requests so far, I think including the ones from Stuart himself, since the EU Court of Justice ruled in May recognizing the right to be forgotten. The meetings that Google is sponsoring are led by an advisory council that Google set up following the May ruling and includes ex-privacy officials and ex-judges. Some EU officials have had a positive reaction to the fact that Google is having the meetings. France's chief data protection official referred to it as a PR war, so perhaps viewed it somewhat more negatively. The first of those 7 meetings was held in Madrid last week. The second is in Rome this week, and the others are going to be conducted between now and early November in Paris, Warsaw, Berlin, London, and Brussels. In the meetings, the discussion that Google is trying to have is focused on how to balance the public right to information with the individual's right to be forgotten, and on the fundamental question of whether Google itself should be the one making the decision about in response to takedown requests by individuals. The meeting's actually timely because just today a group of European data protection officials are meeting to work out guidelines on how search engines, not just Google but other search engines as well, should apply the right to be forgotten. So there will be no doubt more to talk about on that issue in coming weeks. Speaking of Google, we have a new competitor for the title of strangest ruling against Google in a European court this year, as a German court has ordered Google to provide more responsive customer support. A consumer group in Germany sued Google, complaining that users who email their customer service email address get an auto-reply to the effect that Google will not be reading or replying to the email because of the large volume of requests it receives, and then it directs users to other online sources of self-help. And consumers complained that this violated the German Telemedia Act, which requires companies to have in place a mechanism to ensure speedy electronic communications with the company. And the court in Germany held that Google's auto-reply message did not comply with the law because it couldn't be considered a communication when it's so one-sided and it makes clear that the emails will not actually be read, let alone responded to. So the court held that Google had to provide some way for users to contact it by email. And Google faces fines of up to $300,000 or more, €250,000, if it doesn't comply. I have to say, at least when you're on hold with a cable company for an hour or more, there's a possibility you'll speak to a real person who won't be able to help you, as opposed to an email address that tells you in advance it's not going to help you. Last week, we told you about how Yelp had prevailed in a case claiming that the company suppresses bad reviews for its advertisers. This week, California adopted a law that should help protect customers' ability to post negative reviews online. Mike, did you look at that law?
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's amazing that this kind of a law is necessary. But there have been a few instances of companies that have buried in their terms of service or their contracts with customers a provision saying that if you write a bad review of us online and a site like Yelp, we're actually going to fine you. There was a few articles this summer about a hotel upstate New York that had something in its contract with people who stayed there saying that if you publish a negative review about our hotel, you're going to get a $500 assessment on your hotel bill. And then the matter that apparently gave rise to the California law involved a Utah couple whose credit score was actually allegedly damaged after they were fined $3,500 for violating a retail company's terms of sale by posting a bad review. So the California law actually makes it a crime to punish someone for writing a negative review, and provides for fines of up to $10,000 if a company violates that law. So it would be interesting to see if, you know, this applies to California businesses, so it would be interesting to see if other states adopt this kind of law the way they typically follow California laws.
Yeah, it will. This week in data breaches, which has become another fairly regular segment since the Target breach, last week we talked about early reports or early indications that Home Depot may have been breached, and I think within a few hours of our taping the podcast, Home Depot in fact confirmed that it had been breached, and the congressional response has been quite predictable. Home Depot is now the latest in a long and increasingly distinguished list of American retailers to suffer a data breach over the last year and a half. They've now confirmed that hackers broke into their point-of-sale systems as early as April. They haven't said how many customers are affected, but did say that the breach affects brick-and-mortar stores in the U.S. and Canada, which I think there are about 2,100 in the Home Depot network. They've said that the breach does not affect online customers and that no PINs for debit cards were taken. For Home Depot's sake, let's hope that they don't have a Target-like experience and have to come back and correct that those representations down the road. But just based on the volume of traffic since April at the stores in the U.S. and Canada, the breach could affect as many as 60 million people. The first class action, the first of what will likely be many, has already been filed in Georgia. And five state AGs are already leading a multi-state investigation of the breach. And as we talked about last week, you've already seen the usual calls on the Hill for the FTC to investigate, as if the FTC needed the encouragement to investigate. Senator Blumenthal and Senator Markey have written a letter asking the FTC to investigate. We talked last week about the fact that Senator Jay Rockefeller issued a statement saying that the breach underscored the need for data breach legislation. And as we talked about last week, after the Target breach, it was almost the thing to do for someone in the Senate to have sponsored or co-sponsored some form of data breach legislation, but none of those bills went really anywhere, despite many of them having bipartisan support. So it'll be interesting to see whether this breach is the straw that broke the camel's back and actually spurs Congress to act instead of just talking about acting. On a related front, and speaking of our friend Judge Koh, Mike, Judge Koh found that Adobe breach victims have standing based on a risk of future harm, which is a bit of a departure from what has become the traditional standing analysis in these cases. What can you tell us about that?
Most cases, courts in breach cases have been deciding that plaintiffs don't have standing to sue in federal court based just on the risk of future harm, where there hasn't been evidence of identity theft or any other concrete monetary loss. And this trend has been solidified by the Supreme Court's decision in Clapper v. Amnesty International, which involved NSA surveillance. And there the court said that you've got to show certainly impending harm. If it hasn't already taken place, it has to be certainly impending. And what Judge Koh found basically was that, that doesn't mean it has to be absolutely certain. It can be enough if there's a credible threat of real and immediate harm that's sufficiently concrete. And she found that here it was sufficiently concrete and imminent because you had hackers that deliberately targeted Adobe servers. They actually used Adobe's own system to decrypt customer credit card numbers. And some customers' personal information had already shown up online. So in these circumstances, she said it's not speculative that these plaintiffs are likely to suffer harm. It's pretty concrete. Now, I think this will be helpful to plaintiffs in breach cases because I think it's a very well-written opinion. And she also distinguished Clapper on the ground that, look, the court there specifically said it was applying standing analysis rigorously because this was a challenge to the constitutionality of government conduct. And, of course, that's not the case in run-of-the-mill breach cases. And this isn't going to help plaintiffs in, you know, the very stereotypical lost laptop case where there's no evidence that somebody was seeking the personal information, let alone accessed it. But whereas here somebody is deliberately targeting personal information and seems to have had success in getting access to some of it, I think we'll start to see some courts actually finding standing. Now, of course, you still got to show some sort of harm in order to state a viable cause of action, but at least you'll have your day in federal court and get past a motion to dismiss if you can make some plausible allegation of concrete loss.
This week, a group of tech companies again tried to ramp up the pressure for reform of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and in the and there was also a development in the related Microsoft search warrant litigation. I'll take the first, and Mike will take the second. So for background, since at least 2009, there's been a coalition of privacy groups and tech companies that have been mounting a campaign to try to get Congress to update ECPA and the Stored Communications Act, which was adopted in 1986. The principal issue that these groups have raised has been the standard that law enforcement has to meet in order to obtain stored content like emails from providers. The statute, as written now, makes a number of distinctions in terms of the standards that law enforcement has to meet and the process that law enforcement has to use in order to get stored email based on such things as the age of the email and whether or not the email has been opened. And this coalition called Digital Due Process has argued for the last 4 or 5 years that the standard should be probable cause across the board. One of my least favorite jobs when I was at DOJ, along with Jim Baker, who's now the general counsel at the FBI, was the two of us were a tag team campaign on the Hill to try to blunt the momentum for the bill to be changed. For whatever reason, either because we're incredibly persuasive or because the effort was to try to get the U.S. Congress to do something, there wasn't much progress made. And there were bills in both houses that would have accomplished what the coalition wanted, but there was very little action. That was true even after the Department of Justice in March of last year announced that it would no longer oppose a warrant for all content standard, which was a significant departure from its position during the time that I was there. And there was no action even after the Snowden leaks created a public outcry about privacy and government access to data generally. These same tech companies wrote to the White House in August of last year urging the administration to make ECPA reform part of its efforts to address the privacy issues in the wake of Snowden. And now these same groups, and along with their privacy group colleagues, are pushing Congress to act on ECPA reform again asking congressional leaders to hold votes on the various reform bills that are out there. As Mike was quoted as saying in corporate counsel recently, and I'll paraphrase him badly, no one should be holding their breath waiting for Congress to act here because it can't act on anything right now and has a very short time left before it breaks for the campaign season. So despite the renewed effort, I think it's unlikely that you'll see much action. And the fact that what they're asking for is no longer particularly controversial, I think you will not see much action in ECPA reform. Mike, I don't know if you have anything to add on that, but I know you were going to tell us about what happened in the Microsoft search warrant litigation this week.
Yeah, and then the two are somewhat related, and I'll get to that at the end. But, you know, we've talked several times now about the Microsoft search warrant case, and that's a case in which the government served a search warrant on Microsoft in the U.S. Demanding access to emails that are stored in Ireland. And Microsoft has moved to vacate the warrant on the ground that search warrants don't apply extraterritorially. A federal magistrate here in New York denied that motion, saying that the warrant wasn't actually being applied extraterritorially because Microsoft can go get the emails and turn them over here in the United States. A federal district court judge upheld that ruling, and so now Microsoft has appealed to the Second Circuit. Now, initially, the government agreed to a stay pending appeal, but then it moved to vacate the stay, saying, "Well, you know, we've rethought about this a little bit more, and there's actually no grounds for appeal because there's been no final order that's appealable." And the only way to get a final order is if the court holds Microsoft in contempt for failing to comply with the search warrant. Microsoft, of course, disagreed, but Chief Judge Preska once again agreed with the government and said, I'm holding Microsoft in contempt. So Microsoft has now appealed the contempt order as well. Even though Microsoft disagreed, it sort of reached an agreement with the government. They stipulated to this, really, saying that there won't be any criminal sanctions or contempt sanctions against Microsoft, and the government's not going to try to enforce the search warrant until there's a resolution on the merits by the Second Circuit. So so basically, this caused a little bit of a flurry at the end of August, beginning of September, and now we're moving on to the Second Circuit, and there will be a lot more companies, I think, filing amicus briefs. There were only four at the district court stage, and I think there'll be a lot more getting involved at the Second Circuit. And this ties into ECPA reform because I think, you know, one of the issues that some companies and some civil liberties organizations are going to be pursuing is another amendment to ECPA that says that search warrants don't apply to data stored abroad, or at least not in run-of-the-mill circumstances. And I think there's negotiation going on now among companies and the civil liberties groups about exactly what the language should say. That will be more controversial. It'll certainly be opposed by the government. But that's not going to change what you said in conclusion, which is that very unlikely anything's going to pass this year. I mean, I don't know how many days Congress is going to be in session, but I can probably count them on two hands.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that the controversy over the whether a search warrant applies to content stored abroad is going to be so much more controversial. It's going to make the dispute over whether a warrant should be required in the first place look like nothing. And by itself might you know, tube any effort to reform the bill. So that's our roundup for the week, and now we turn to our discussion with Deputy Undersecretary Schneck, and for that we turn to Mark Fry.
Okay. Thanks, Jason. And Phyllis, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I think we're going to talk about a bunch of things DHS and go over some of the ground, particularly some of the breach discussions that we heard earlier. But before we get into some of those details, perhaps as a scene setter, you could spend a few moments just telling us about, you know, DHS's highest priorities these days with respect to cybersecurity, and maybe as a part of that, throw in a bit about the status of cybersecurity legislation, although I suspect the conclusion is going to be similar to the one we've just talked about with respect to any other legislation, at least for the remainder of this year.
Sure. So thank you. First of all, thank you all very much for having me today. And I want to thank Steptoe Johnson and certainly thank Stuart Baker, who you say he likes the right to be forgotten, but he's not forgotten. And I just wanted to thank him very much for the invitation, known and respected him for many years. Just to back up a little bit, my role in the department is to look at our cybersecurity vision, both with the cybersecurity and communications component of the National Protection of Programs Directorate reporting up to me, including our Office of Emergency Communications, as well as all of our programs and partnerships with NCS&C, as well as I'm chartered with working to the One DHS effort, and that's what we call our unity of effort towards cybersecurity, working with many different parts of the department, including the Secret Service, our law enforcement component, as well as Homeland Security Investigations, also law enforcement, and obviously Coast Guard and our CIO and FEMA and our research and development teams, and others looking at what our cyber vision is as a department. My priorities for cybersecurity for the National Protection and Programs Directorate, where we look at cybersecurity, obviously, for infrastructure resilience. So beyond chasing viruses and worms, but really making sure that we keep our way of life working. Resilience being you can function while you're under attack, and I'll talk a little bit about that. My top priorities start with number one being trust with our stakeholders. I've been here a year and a week. I love it. It's a privilege and an honor. And the one thing I realize is how much I learned in my past in private sector. It's important to have relationships built on trust long before you need them and long before crisis. So really building those relationships out with our .gov stakeholders and certainly across our critical infrastructure in the private sector and academia. My second very large high-level priority is situational awareness. So building for the department and with our teams here an understanding of what is happening around our globe in cybersecurity, and really changing this game by using what we see when we protect systems through all of our programs, both with humans and machines, using that to learn. We call it see something, say something in the physical security world, and making sure that that is an active tenet of what we do in cybersecurity. So anywhere something happens in cyber, that should and will be used to protect and inform others that we protect as well. And certainly all of these extend to working with our interagency partners as well, such as the FBI and NSA and others. Priority three, and there are many, but I'm giving you the top three. Three is really leveraging that cybersecurity framework that comes from Presidential Executive Order 13636 and using that to not only work with our larger companies to look at best practices in cybersecurity, but to leverage that set of best practices and extend that out to our small to mediums and state and locals that very often, due to budget constraints or in some cases lack of awareness in the very small companies, don't have the best cybersecurity. Yet when we look at the structures, these are the companies that serve the larger companies. So really using that framework to put cybersecurity into the boardroom, if we don't do it, the adversary will, and make securing our electronic connectivity part of the upfront risk assessment, again, going towards resilience. And I think those three priorities tie together. I'll pause for a moment before we go to legislation to make sure that, are there any questions on that?
That's a great overview of the waterfront, so we appreciate that. I think we're going to dig into a couple of those issues in just a moment, so perhaps we should pause just to talk briefly about legislation, and then we can follow up on the framework and the work with interagency partners and the overall status of what you're calling situational awareness and, you know, information sharing.
I'll jump on your words, information sharing. When it comes to legislation, we are still working with the Senate on that. I'll say very, very thankful to the hard work of Senators Feinstein and Chambliss. Senator Chambliss comes from Georgia, where I went to Georgia Tech, so that's near and dear for me. But we're still working with them on that. We're really looking at two things right now to come out of some of the bills. One is to reform FISMA so that it's operational. What I mean by that is enable DHS to go in and scan networks of our .gov stakeholders. An example of where this would have helped us a lot was in the Heartbleed vulnerability, as you know. Basically a bug in an open source piece of software that was running and is running likely everywhere. And we wasted a lot of time, really used a lot of time working out legal agreements to demonstrate legally to each agency's lawyers that we needed to be there, and probably had 7 to 10 days of time where bad guys who now knew about the event could exploit it. And so we're working to make sure that we have the clear statutory authorities next time so that does not happen. And the other piece is what I'm going to say, codifying our NCIC. But our NCIC is our National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center. Translation to be the 24/7 watch center for, it's really the heart and soul of cybersecurity. And when I look at that, that means showing what the role is. That center is alive and well, constantly in the cycle of receiving information from either our programs, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, so machines sending data back, again, with the full leveraging of our privacy and civil liberties experts, and I'm going to talk to you about that in a moment, but that NCIC is receiving data from our programs that protect federal agencies. It's receiving data from our partners, from our critical infrastructure stakeholders, from companies, agencies that feel they've been victims that call us, and from CERTs across the world, Computer Emergency, either Response or Readiness Teams, however they use the acronym. And as that information comes in, our analysts and machines learn from it, and that role is to respond and mitigate cyber threat across our government and private sector stakeholders. And within that National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center sits our U.S. CERT, that Cyber Emergency Readiness Team, where we have the people that either we call the flyaway teams, but they could actually get on an airplane and go out and mitigate the threat at a victim or deal with the victim or clean it up for them, keep them, again, to resilience online and running. We also have our malware teams, our experts. Some people I've seen that referred to as cyber ninjas, but that is the cyber elite. And another piece of that is our industrial control system CERT as well, again, all within that NCIC or National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center umbrella. So the ability for legislation to codify that role, to not only coordinate, but really use that capability to go out, mitigate the threat, to be the heart of see something, say something. We lead that, plus, again, that FISMA reform to enable us to show that we have the in-statute, the authorities to go in and help those .gov partners. The technical people and the scientists knew we should be there. To their credit, the lawyers were looking at the legal ways that we'd be getting on the network, and we lost a lot of time and gave the bad guys an advantage with that. So we're looking to mitigate that forward and, again, continue working with the Senate on these information sharing bills. We think a lot of good progress has been made.
Well, thank you. I won't ask you for a prediction on whether that passes in the near or medium term. And I think we'll return to the NCIC and what's working and what some of the challenges are in a moment. But I want to go back to perhaps priorities 1 and 3, sort of establishing trust with the various stakeholders, particularly in the critical infrastructure sector writ large, and leveraging the framework, and ask if you could talk a little bit about the impact of the framework to date, you know, how well it's been, I don't know if the word is going to be adopted, implemented, accepted, what some of the next steps are coming up. We're coming up, I guess, on the beginning steps of Framework 2.0, and what DHS sees as the road ahead for the framework.
So absolutely. First of all, in building trust, we invest a lot in our partnerships, not only with the Critical Infrastructure Protection Structure, the National Infrastructure Protection Plan, which identifies the various critical infrastructure sectors and pairs them with lead agencies that are non-regulatory. So you have the ability for a government and private sector to share information and really talk about actual science without being susceptible to sort of outside publication of those discussions. We have a program called CISP that looks at critical infrastructure security, but you enable the hardcore scientists to come in from in a non-competitive, sort of transcending those competitive boundaries kind of a way, where we can actually look with our stakeholders at various, for example, pieces of malware or ways of mitigating threats together. And you'll find, and I learned a lot of this in earlier days, but running the private sector side of the FBI's InfraGuard program, how you build trust locally and by working hard with people on the same very difficult issues and really opening your doors. We bring our stakeholders in. When we can, show them the operations of our NCIC and really work to make sure that you know and they know who they will call before a crisis. And we're very, very proud of that because that's the people side. And I would argue that cybersecurity is not just a technical problem. It's very much a people problem. Most science problems may be able to be solved these days with a couple of pizzas and a Mountain Dew and a group of smart people. We have the smart people. We have the cyber elite. A lot of this is also a policy and a trust question. And I think that, you know, you mentioned Snowden earlier. I'll say that now there's never been a time that information sharing has been needed more. And now's not the time to stop doing that. So what we need to do is leverage, which we do in the department, our privacy and civil liberties teams. We have the only statutory privacy officer, I believe, in civilian government. We leverage those teams throughout every program and project that we build. We not only tell the public very transparently on our website exactly what we collect, what we do with it, and why, but we really look at how our programs are built and how the code is written to make sure that everything is done to the full extent of privacy and civil liberties. And we have teams and experts and lawyers that advise us constantly on that. So that enables us to build those trusted programs that not only build the trust between people, but also allow us, for example, to collect information from our intrusion detection and prevention programs for the U.S. government and our continuous diagnostics and mitigation programs and work with federal CIOs on how to, and we could talk about priority two in a moment, really create that situational awareness. But we are all about building that trust and telling the public exactly what we do. And I believe that is needed now more than ever. That brings me to the framework. I saw the development of Framework 1 from both sides. 6 months of that, I was in the private sector, and it was my teams and myself that were in some of those discussions on what those best practices should look like with industry and NIST. And then the remaining 6 months was after I started here at DHS on the government side. A lot of good people put best practices into that framework. It makes it a very valuable document at the Treasury, and it's had very, very good acceptance. Our formal name for our program for framework adoption, as you may have heard, is our C-cubed VP, or Critical Infrastructure and Cybersecurity Community Voluntary Program. Notice the critical infrastructure comes first in that title, showing that we do cybersecurity to keep our critical way of life, our critical infrastructures running. And we build the word community into that because the beauty of the framework is that the best practices can be shared. They're not prescriptive, but they are ways that, for example, a large company can require, for example, of smaller companies that provide services to, again, invest in better cybersecurity up front, thus reducing risk and improving resilience. We've seen a lot of good reaction to this. We've seen a lot of people not only wanting to adopt it, but I have gone out with the teams and talked to small to medium businesses about, and we actually did a request for information or an RFI on this when I came in. How do we enable our, and again, that business fabric is 99% of our business fabric, your small to medium. How do we enable them to use the framework to drive cybersecurity markets? So I leverage my private sector background here, but a company wants to make money, and they should. So use the framework to drive revenue, to create technologies that are better and maybe less expensive, that in the end, the use of which will make all of us more secure. And our hope is that that will get leveraged again to, as I mentioned before, bring cybersecurity investment to a boardroom risk decision, and while also enabling the largest part of our business fabric to thrive and generate more products and go sell them. On the state and local side, one of the first things I did was work with our teams to write a check so that we would end up funding for a short-term managed security services for our state and local governments in exchange for them adopting the framework. And adopting the framework could be on a spectrum from very little to a lot, but that was embraced. And again, that is to bring that cybersecurity investment to the forefront in the state and local governments. And in that case, we know they know in many cases how much they have to protect. It's a pure budget question, and it's our hope that this time while we're attempting to fund their managed security services, they will take that time to look at how in the next budget cycle to put cybersecurity up front as an investment priority. Another piece that we look at, I work for Undersecretary Spaulding, and she and I both have a passion for working with the venture capitalists and really looking at our West Coast and our innovation and making sure that we bridge what they call Washington out there to see that Washington is also packed with people that want to bring good practices to business. And it's not just about politics, and really working with those people that not only start companies but fund companies to, again, raise the level of priority of cybersecurity investment, both in the innovation and new technologies, but also in the protection of those investments.
Excellent. Well, thank you. And I guess the follow-on question, since it's been in effect for a little while, and as we said, we're perhaps moving towards version 2.0, are we making progress? I mean, is the framework having an effect? If so, are there any particular indicators that we can point to and look at and say, okay, we see adoption by more companies, we see investments like the ones you've talked about, or are we still too early in the game to have those metrics?
So one of the indicators I've seen more and more strongly recently is the enthusiasm we get when we mention the framework. More and more people have heard of it. We get a lot of enthusiasm when we go out west and talk about it because it is best practices. It does give those who fund and create new innovative technologies a way to insist on cybersecurity. And it does answer the question of how can the investments and mindshare that goes into many of our large companies' security be transferred down to their providers, to those smaller companies that provide services to them, and the ability to use some of the tenets in the framework, which are, albeit very general, and in some cases you could call it obvious, it's a way for them to say these are the best practices that level set where we need to be. And it's also a good way when we talk with other governments to look at what they're doing, to show them the best practices that are used here, and begin conversations about on the policy side, since we are all connected globally, how we can bring that cyber risk investment to their boardrooms as well. And I've seen very, very positive reaction to that.
Thank you. Shifting gears just a bit to a more specific breach discussion, we heard in the earlier part of the program discussion of two recent breaches, and you referenced a couple in your comments as well. So I was wondering if you could expand upon those just a little bit, and it'd be the same question as in this framework. You know, are we making progress generally, either as at the government level or at the private sector level in responding to these breaches. And if then perhaps for some of the uninitiated out there, if you could spend a moment talking about the different role that DHS plays with respect to a breach than, let's say, that the FBI may play.
So certainly, and this is quite the week for this conversation. You know, as I've told many people as we watch the news, this is going to keep happening. You will see more and more of these breaches, more and more big names. For both, it's a vector. There are two reasons. One is you'll see more and more companies reporting or noticing and then reporting. And the other is you'll see more and more companies getting breached. But we have made progress, and you might ask, how can that be? And the issue is this. We are about cyber resilience and understanding and having the expectation that this will keep happening, but also having the expectation that we will run well under attack and getting to the point where, again, we see something, say something in our networks, so making our networks and using my priority too, that situational awareness plus our personal relationships to ensure that we have the data we need to, when we see something, use it to block it again elsewhere and recognize it. But also work a little bit like the human body's immune system and say that we know we are going to get bacteria. We know that every time we get on a plane, the person next to us has a cold, but that likely we're not going to get sick, and if we do, we'll fight it. And that's how cyber networks need to work. And if you look at the programs that DHS administers, those are the very foundational principles. As we protect both the perimeter in the Einstein programs, as well as our ability to protect private sector critical infrastructure with classified indicators. We also have the continuous diagnostics and mitigation programs, which look at, for example, what's patched or what's open inside of each agency's network. We're able to not only keep those networks safer, but learn from those government networks. We don't take any data from the private sector side, but learn from the government networks and take in all that data in combination with what we're learning from everybody else and put it back out as rapidly as possible, both in report form as well as in forms that are automated for your machines to read. The fun words are sticks and taxi, so trusted automated exchange of indicator information. I didn't name it, but I love it. And that's a protocol that talks literally, you hear the words machine to machine, and that means that just like I send you an email, machines can automatically generate information about whether the traffic that's coming to you is good or bad. And as we increase that situational awareness and the ability for our networks to respond, we increase our knowledge and you will see resilience go up. So even though it's unbearably easy for the bad guys right now to get into all kinds of networks because there are all kinds of holes, I do believe there's a tipping point ahead. But I'm also going to tell you candidly, I expect the number of breaches about which we hear to certainly rise, but we do expect resilience to improve over the next few years. That coming twofold, one because I believe that programs from DHS and many, many others, in conjunction, for, of course, with our private sector colleagues at the National Cybersecurity Association, as we sponsor National Cybersecurity Awareness Month in October, really reaching out to citizens as well as companies as well as government, to really say, stop and think before you connect. I think you'll see, just like when seatbelts were put in cars, as Howard Schmidt said 12 years ago, you will see the resilience start to rise from these efforts together. But just like we still see car accidents and we still see bank robberies, you're not going to see the announcements stop. But I believe that we will get to a point where some of this very obvious use of vulnerabilities that should have been stopped will end, and our strongest minds can go hunt for the worst events, right? Because there's a spectrum, and there are financial events, and there are DDoS, we call distributed denial of service, we're just flooding the networks types of events. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there are very harmful events where it could affect our critical infrastructure, where you can end up shutting down machines en masse. And we really want to look for that hard, destructive event and be able to be there before it happens and have the awareness and have the resilience to bring things back up online. Because, again, at DHS and specifically the National Protection of Programs Directorate, we look at cybersecurity as part of infrastructure resilience. And overall in DHS, our secretary has said this many times publicly, and I love this phrase. I fully agree with it. Cybersecurity is part of homeland security. And part of that is that awareness, that see something, say something, with the expectation that the adversaries are not going to quit.
Thanks for that. I think just as a concluding thought, since I see we're running short on time. We've talked, and you've talked very helpfully about a number of DHS programs and centers, whether the NCIC, we mentioned Einstein, we mentioned indicators and that information sharing. We talked about the CDM program internal to the DHS networks. So quite a lot is going on. And so as a concluding thought, I was just wondering if you could maybe take a step back and talk briefly about what are some of the challenges you see going forward. You talk, you know, about perhaps getting the NCIC codified, for example, but is there anything else that sort of is front burner challenge at the moment that you or that DHS more generally is working to address?
I think I'll frame that question as a couple of things that I find most, probably my most interesting parts of my job. One is working with our interagency partners. So where our NCIC and my piece of the world has responsibility for the response and mitigation to cyber threat. We have our law enforcement component in the Secret Service and certainly in Homeland Security Investigations, which is part of ICE, and also with the FBI. And as we work together, we are making a lot of great progress in how we work with both FBI and the intelligence community to have everybody do their respective roles and make sure that in the end our stakeholders are protected. We are learning from each other. It's been it's actually fun. And I think that you'll see a lot of that streamlined going forward. It's very exciting. And you can never end a good conversation that mentions information sharing without talking about our Office of Emergency Communications, which is was an education for me when I came in. A little insight because, you know, everybody talks a lot about how they are connected and with whom they share information. None of that is really as possible without communication. And when the lines go down, it's our Office of Emergency Communications that's responsible for making sure that there's another way to have lines on which to communicate. So they administer, for example, the GETS program, Government Emergency Telecommunications System. And I think it's so important for our community and our general public to realize that communications and cybersecurity are part of each other. They're part of infrastructure resilience, and they're part of Homeland Security. And every day in this job is different, new, and exciting, and we are very proud to be here.
Great. Well, thanks again for those thoughtful comments and for joining us. And with that, I will turn it back over to Jason for any of his concluding thoughts.
Phyllis, I would just say if the official title or the business card of the job you mentioned earlier actually says Cyber Ninja, I have two tech-savvy little boys at home who are ready to sign up. Thank you, Phyllis, and thank you, Mark, and thank you to Michael for participating in the broadcast today. Before we sign off, we have a tradition of giving everyone, our guests and participants, an opportunity to plug any upcoming speaking engagements you have. Phyllis, I don't know if there's anything on the calendar that you'd like to tell the audience about.
I'll just say that September is National Preparedness Month, October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and November is Resilience Month. And that doesn't mean we only think that each topic deserves 1 month. There are 11 more for each, but you'll see a lot of the DHS community engaging with the national community on all these topics and how they're inextricably linked over the next 3 months.
Later this week, although it can't possibly compete with the three-month sequence you have in front of you, I'll be in the International Association of Privacy Professionals West Coast Conference later this week talking about privacy and security issues raised by Bitcoin and the growth of virtual currencies. So you'll need lots of coffee for that. This has been episode 34 of the Steptoe Cyber Law podcast brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Mark Frive, Dr. Phil Schenek, Mike Vadas for participating in the show this week. We hope you'll join us next week when we're joined by FTC Commissioner Julie Brill and will once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. Thanks for joining us.